Ladies, gentlemen, director, pro-director, colleagues, welcome to the Sir Daniel Stevenson Memorial Lecture. As many of you know, this is an annual event established jointly by the Royal Institute of International Affairs and by the school in memory of Sir Daniel Macaulay Stevenson, 1851-1944, engineer, coal merchant, city father of Glasgow, patron and sometime chancellor of Glasgow University, pillar of the Liberal Party, and benefactor of Chatham House and of the school, where he endowed the chair of international history that bears his name. Sir Daniel's purpose thereby was to foster dispassionate historical investigation as the sovereign remedy against nationalist fanaticism. Judging from the contemporary scene, dispassionate historical investigation is no less necessary now than it was in Sir Daniel's day. And it's especially fitting that we commemorate him in this centenary year of a school whose motto it is to investigate the causes of things. Our speaker tonight is well known to many of us. Professor Lawrence Friedman has come to us, quite literally, from across the street at King's College, where he has long led the very distinguished Department of War Studies. He is the foremost authority in this country, and one of the foremost in the world, on the history of nuclear strategy. He's also written numerous works distinguished by their polish and analytical rigor on other aspects of contemporary strategic and diplomatic affairs, from the Falklands War to the Persian Gulf. Tonight, his subject is Vietnam and the disillusioned strategists, a topic of particular interest to me in 1969 as a very young infantry lieutenant. I and my troops had considerable occasion to ponder from a strictly practical point of view, the mysteries of U.S. strategy in Vietnam, the absence of any apparent provision for what, in the language of international relations, would now be called war termination. Professor Friedman's topic tonight, I believe, is one of very great general interest. And without further ceremony, I give you Professor Friedman.
In his search for the origins of war, Donald Kagan took his cue from Thucydides' observation that people go to war out of honor, fear, and interest, and fixed on honor as the neglected factor. According to Kagan, this should not be thought of simply as a synonym for fame and glory, but rather as, quote, deference, esteem, just due, regard, respect, or prestige. Honor in these senses, he writes, is desirable in itself, but it also has practical importance in the competition for power. When it is on the wane, so too is the power of the state losing it, and the reverse is also true. Reading this led me to recall a famous passage of Tom Schelling's when he wrote that face is one of the few things worth fighting over. Though, quote, few parts of the world are intrinsically worth the risk of serious war by themselves, especially when taken slice by slice, he acknowledged nonetheless that defending them or running them may preserve one's commitments to actions in other parts of the world and at later times. One can think of many examples where great powers have apparently acted on this conviction. Richard Nixon's anxiety prior to the incursion into Cambodia in 1970 that the United States might be seen as a helpless, pitiful giant. Reports that Ronald Reagan could always be persuaded to persist with a hopeless policy in Beirut in 1983 by reference to the consequences of appearing to have cut and run or been driven out. To more recent fretting in and around the Clinton administration over impressions created by the abrupt withdrawal from Somalia or the vacillations on policy towards Bosnia. These concerns over fate or honor or reputation can readily distort policy making. This is largely because they are often used as an argument for persevering with a failed policy rather than as for a prudent course of change of course, which in the long run may turn out to have spared a reputation. It's not, however, any part of my argument tonight to suggest that what may appear as a morbid fear of U-turns in policy is necessarily based on an irrelevant consideration. The expectation others have of future behavior will inevitably reflect past behavior. The question is whether it is possible to integrate this interest, which usually goes well beyond the immediate stakes in a particular conflict, into the development of a strategy for that particular conflict. And this question, I think, is important for strategic theory because of the difficulty of combining concerns over honour with the more familiar fear and interest. It's altogether less tangible, less easy to measure and identify. It provides an intuitive test of the quality of a policy rather than a specific goal in itself, and is best appreciated retrospectively. Because an appeal to honour can be persuasive despite being imprecise, it cuts across any strategic advice which attempts to offer a clear route to a specific goal. It can also take two forms. There is the honour of right or of might, of the promotion of justice or of order, to be earned by a readiness to accept sacrifices in the name of cherished values, or else as the due of one who has acquired the aura of power. These two types of honour create quite distinct policy imperatives and are often in direct conflict with each other. I want to explore this issue tonight by reference to decisions being taken 30 years ago this month. In February 1965, the United States decided to step up its commitment to the government of South Vietnam by means of a bombing campaign directed against the North, known as Rolling Thunder. This decision was a turning point in the Vietnam War, and indeed in contemporary history, and for that reason alone has been examined in great detail. It was in fact, as this decision was being taken, that Tom Schelling, here in London at that time, was putting down his thoughts on face being worth fighting for. The mid-1960s were in some ways the culminating point of what had been an unusually innovative period in Western strategic thinking. Accounts of American decision-making in 1964 and early 1965 often draw attention to the influence of theorists such as Schelling and Herman Kahn and the concepts of flexible response and coercive diplomacy. John Gaddis, for example, discusses Vietnam in terms of the implementation of prevailing views about flexible response, soon to be adopted as the official NATO doctrine, and the belief in the possibility of calibration or fine-tuning when applying military force to deal with a limited aggression. This was designed to avoid suffering humiliation by doing too little or escalation by doing too much. Certainly, a succession of air power theorists has blamed ideas of this nature for the failure of Rolling Thunder. They have derided the strategic concept for failing to grasp the importance of decisive blows rather than steady and graduated pressure. Meanwhile, others have used it as a test case for theories of coercive diplomacy. So it's therefore a secondary purpose of this lecture to explore the role of strategic theory in the formulation of Vietnam policy up to February 1965, and the various factors which shaped this core concept of flexible response. Let me move to the origins of these core concepts then, and I want to trace them to the debates over limited war which took place in the 1950s. This occurred as the developing nuclear stalemate appeared to rule out total war as a way of resolving disputes among the great powers. It was the crises of the early 1960s, first Berlin and then Cuba, which gave practical meaning to this theoretical debate. American military planning over Berlin, for example, was shaped by the operational difficulties of reinforcing and defending a Western enclave in the middle of East Germany. Politically, it was constrained by the need to offer no concessions on the city's overall status or the West's formal commitment to German reunification, even while recognizing that American, and for that matter British public opinion, could not accept nuclear war for the sake of Allied access rights to Berlin. Because the Kennedy administration was reluctant to rely on the general deterrent threat of nuclear war, it pushed for a greater range of conventional options, including a number which might be employed early on in the face of a Soviet campaign to squeeze the West out of Berlin. In this way, the logic of graduated response which had already pushed its way to the mainstream of strategic thought, acquired a new edge as it worked its way through the contingency planning for the most likely trigger of a total war. The Cuban Missile Crisis then offered hope that this theory might be workable in practice. In considering the influence of Cuba, we must take account of its historiography. The general view in the years immediately after the crisis was that President Kennedy had been prepared to concede little, and had actually conceded less, in order to convince Khrushchev to back down. That the United States had emerged with honor in both senses. It had persevered with a firm stance, but with an admirable restraint. From the start, policy had been directed towards the aim of removing the new missile threat. Moscow was never in any doubt about what was required. The only question was what it could extract from Washington in return. Moreover, in imposing the quarantine around Cuba, Kennedy and his advisers had hit upon a method which conveyed the right political message. Any military value was actually incidental. And this comes over in one of the first post-Kennedy insiders' accounts, which incidentally was also published about the time of these Vietnam decisions. This is by Ted Sorensen, and he talks of the quarantine's advantages in the following terms. Precisely because it was a limited, low-level action, the blockade had the advantage of permitting a more controlled escalation on our part, gradual or rapid as the situation required. It could serve as an unmistakable but not sudden or humiliating warning to Khrushchev of what we expected from him. Its prudence, its avoidance of casualties, and its avoidance of attacking Cuban soil would make it more appealing to other nations than an airstrike, permitting OAS and Allied support for our initial position, and making that support more likely for whatever airstrike or other action was later necessary. Here can be seen the preoccupation with questions of image. The potential political meaning of military moves had to be considered in terms of how they might be interpreted by allies and the audience of world opinion, as well as by the adversary. The claims for this combination of resolution and restraint might have been at least qualified had more been known about the informal trade on the Jupiter missiles in Turkey. But this was not made public until the posthumous publication of Robert Kennedy's 13 Days in 1969. The secrecy with which that implicit trade was held, so that allies would not be alarmed at the administration's readiness to sell them out, misled all those who sought to draw lessons from this conflict up to that point. Indeed, the administration had been anxious that very particular lessons be drawn from what was acclaimed as a triumph for American diplomacy. Responsibility for outlining these lessons fell to Undersecretary of State George Ball, who had been one of the key players during the crisis and was to be the most senior and eloquent exponent of restraint over Vietnam. Ball explained how Cuba confirmed the wisdom, indeed the necessity, of measured response. This doctrine, I quote, minimized the risk of nuclear incineration. By establishing the quarantine, the president developed an effective weapon, a weapon with economic as well as military implication, that may usefully be included in the growing arsenal that provides for the free world the widest spectrum of response to military and political threats. This generally optimistic approach also influenced civilian strategists. Their response involved not so much relief that the world had narrowly averted Armageddon, than cheer at how a crisis could be managed satisfactorily with an extremely limited show of force. Some complained that the central lesson had been obscured by the overdrawn language in which the outcome of the crisis and the performance of the administration had been discussed. Tom Schelling later recalled listening to the president's speech at a Harvard-MIT arms control seminar that night at the faculty club. He said, "I remember after the speech, we were left with a sense of gloating. We just couldn't imagine how Khrushchev could have done such a dumb, blundering act. And we knew that we had him on this one. And the only question was how bad a fall we were going to give him." After the crisis, Schelling, in written form, responded enthusiastically. "Cuba should be construed," he wrote, as an actual instance of a new species of limited war, described as a competition in risk-taking, a military diplomatic maneuver with or without a military engagement, but with the outcome determined by manipulation of risk rather than by an actual contest of force. A new type of limited war, perhaps, but one conducted very much in the context of a superpower confrontation. Cuba was called in aid to support positions taken in a vigorous debate over NATO strategy, and the Kennedy administration's determination to push through the doctrine of flexible response despite the misgivings of its allies. It was taken to demonstrate the possibility of military steps which could convey resolution, but without setting in motion a military dynamic with its own inner logic, the sort of process that the term escalation had originally been coined to describe. And this was even though the measures taken by the United States during Cuba did not extend into actual combat, and so did not provide a full test of this strategy of graduated pressure. Nevertheless, to those in government who had been through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and this was all the top policymakers dealing with Vietnam, with a notable absence of Kennedy himself, the memory was of a limited, measured action succeeding, and the judgment of those military men prescribing tougher action to have been shown to have been faulty, possibly dangerously so. At a very basic level, it led to self-confidence among this group that it was possible to make the right strategic choices. An optimism that even in the more difficult circumstances of Vietnam, the quote, miracle of the Cuba crisis could be repeated. Both the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and his deputy, Cyrus Vance, have confirmed the influence of Cuba in terms, as they saw it then, of the desirability of avoiding extreme measures and the potential success of more moderate approaches. There were three key features of this evolving conceptual framework, of which two came to be neglected in the focus of this journey, of this concept, through the NATO decision process. The central feature remained the idea of increasing military pressures by stages in order to elicit from the adversary an appropriate political response. A second feature, which was quite specific to the time, was the wretched state of relations between civilian policymakers and the military. It was built on suspicions which went back to MacArthur and Korea. Kennedy felt that he had been let down by his professional military advisers during the Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis. Lyndon Johnson also shared the suspicion that generals were inclined to war because they needed, quote, battles and bombs and bullets to be heroic. The grip on Pentagon affairs taken by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara and his civilian staff had appalled the military, who disliked intensely the introduction of newfangled concepts of program budgeting and strategic analysis. The idea that military force might be used for purposes of coercive diplomacy in preference to a decisive battle went to the heart of this tension. The second factor, which has turned out to be more constant, though still inadequately incorporated into strategic theory, is the problem of legitimation. It not only matters to policymakers themselves to believe that they are doing the right thing, but they want to be able to convince their own public opinion and that of allies and other interested spectators of this. In the end, it is the job of politicians to ensure that policies are informed by a keen sense of their marketability. This is easiest to accomplish when it can be demonstrated that difficult and potentially hazardous measures have only been taken in response to the aggression or escalation of the adversary. This interacts with my broad theme of honor or reputation, and the tension between the restraint normally considered necessary for legitimacy and the toughness and resolution often thought essential to a reputation as a power with which it is unwise to tangle, between being honored for being good and honored for being powerful. In order to throw some light on how, if at all, this conceptual framework influenced the development of a strategy for Vietnam, I want to focus on one man, on the input of John McNaughton, first general counsel, and then from 1963, assistant secretary for international security affairs at the Pentagon, and defense secretary Robert McNamara's main advisor on Vietnam. McNaughton is the disillusioned strategist of my title. McNaughton was a brilliant academic lawyer from Harvard who died tragically in an air crash in July 1967 and therefore left no memoir to explain what he thought he was doing. He is described by a former deputy as being serious, able, engaging, possessed of a mordant wit, and more than slightly mesmerized by the McNamara mystique. Yet, as David Halberstam observes, when the Pentagon Papers were released, McNaughton, quotes, came to symbolize the inhumane and insensitive quality of that era, and doubting, unreflecting, putting the quantifying of deaths and killing and destruction into neat, cold, antiseptic statistics, devoid of blood and heart. McNamara's biographer, Deborah Shapley, describes bulging files of cynical musings and superficially imaginative ideas. McNaughton tossed around the dice of diplomacy and bombs, as though he were in one more negotiation and not the lone civilian advisor to the US Secretary of Defense preparing to spill blood in war. One of his memos was famously described by a colleague as the reductio ad absurdum of the planner's art, combining realpolitik with the hyper-rationalist belief in control of the most refined American think tank. Shapley describes his work, his staff work for McNamara as uniformly obedient and limited. Furthermore, one official of the time, whose own career was broken by his doubts, suggests that McNaughton's ideas were too refined and sophisticated to be forcefully conveyed to the principals. All this seems to me to underestimate the importance of McNaughton as a person and of his ideas. McNamara did not trust military advice, and McNaughton was his top, almost lone civilian advisor. He was also close to McGeorge Bundy, the other main driver of American policy, who at one point was suggesting that McNaughton be sent to Saigon to oversee the implementation of American strategy. More importantly, McNaughton was an early doubter on Vietnam and asked himself all the right questions. He was driven at all times by his commitment to rationalism in problem solving, and this led him to dwell on the risk that the underlying weakness of South Vietnam would entrap the United States, that the availability of options would allow Washington to maintain an illusion of control, even though the various measures available, from bombing to sending in ground troops, could not make a decisive difference. He is recorded chiding Michael Forrestal for his optimism that we can turn this thing off and that we can get off it whenever we want. The trouble is, he warned, if we haven't stopped it today, then the reasons for not stopping it will still exist tomorrow and we'll be in even deeper. Halberstam suggests that these doubts were held in check by his ambition. 1964 was not a good year for doubters, many of whom were squeezed out of the lower ranks of the administration. And McNaughton was still uncertain about his own relationship with McNamara, then in a much more hawkish mode. But while he may have been working within policy parameters set firmly by his boss, the two were clearly on the same intellectual wavelength. Precisely because of his doubts, McNaughton's attempts to rationalize stepping up American policy in Vietnam are extremely revealing as he sought to define a middle way between hawks and doves. Because for my purposes, what is also particularly interesting about McNaughton is his links with the strategic studies community, and in particular his friend Tom Schelling, with whom he worked on the Marshall Plan in the late 1940s. The influence of Schelling had already been very evident in McNaughton's previous Pentagon work on arms control policy. Before discussing the development of McNaughton's ideas, let's recall the strategic dilemma facing the Johnson administration in 1964. The assassination of President Kennedy was on the 22nd of November, 1963, less than 3 weeks after that of Diem in Vietnam. As Johnson settled in as the new president of the United States, the long-term prospects for South Vietnam remained uncertain. As early as January 1964, there was yet another coup within the military junta in Saigon when General Nguyen Khan became premier. Reports from the field suggested a country even less well able than before to resist insurgency. There was no doubt about Johnson's own commitment to the anti-communist cause. He accepted that support of South Vietnam required pressure on the North. But what was such pressure designed to achieve? On the presumption that North Vietnam controlled the National Liberation Front in the South, the Viet Cong, the simple answer was to persuade Hanoi to terminate this support. Less exacting would be concessions from the North in the attempt to find a negotiated settlement. Even more modest still might be a requirement that the communists desist from certain types of action, such as attacks against American targets. Then there was the question of method. On the one hand, there were the direct approaches, such as battling against the insurgency on the ground, protecting sensitive targets, interdiction of the routes by which the North kept the insurgency supplied. On the other hand, there were the more indirect approaches, involving inflicting pain on the North to compel it to change its policies. There was a further critical problem. Behind North Vietnam, it was supposed, was Maoist China, then espousing an unusually virulent radicalism. McNamara, like Lyndon Johnson, was fixated on this Chinese threat. Yet there was also fear of having to take on China directly. Here, as Huan Phuong Kong has reminded us, there was a powerful memory at work, that of Korea. To key policymakers such as Dean Rusk, there was pride in the recollection of aggression contained, as well as a confirmation that with sufficient effort, anti-communist regimes could be sustained. Yet there remained the profound shock of China crossing the Yalu River and inflicting a terrible humiliation on MacArthur's forces at the end of 1950. So the desire to blunt China's influence was an important motive, while at the same time, alarm at the prospect of direct Chinese intervention generated a profound caution in the search for options. McNamara's tendency to disregard military advice was reinforced by the Joint Chiefs' preference for a full-blooded bombing campaign, which he feared would drag in China and, who could tell, even lead to pressures for nuclear use and an even more catastrophic escalation. The available permutations of ends and means indicate just how much more complex Vietnam was than Cuba. There was a further problem. The objective was to calm the situation in the South by dealing with the insurgency, but that depended on the quality of the response of the government in Saigon. Even supposing the Americans were able to get the North to back off or found some means of interrupting the supply lines to the Viet Cong, this could all be negated as a result of the declining authority of the South Vietnamese government and the incompetence of its army. If airstrikes against the North prompted a renewed communist offensive on the ground in the South, then government forces would be unable to cope. If they produced a readiness to negotiate, Saigon's hand would be extremely weak because it controlled barely 30 to 40% of the country. Here was the basic catch-22 of Vietnam. The South could not be stabilized without pressure on the North. The North could not be pressurized without a more stable South. The Kennedy administration had hoped that the end of the Diem regime would allow for a more reformist government. In practice, by colluding in Diem's overthrow, the United States had accepted a degree of responsibility for the quality of the South Vietnamese government. Yet it was at a loss to know what to do beyond exhortations to whomsoever happened to be in power at the time. The only incentive was to warn that without improvement, no serious American military assistance would be forthcoming. But here was another catch-22. The prestige of the United States was now attached to the sustenance of a non-communist South Vietnam. It could therefore not simply walk away from a failing regime, and a threat to do so lacked credibility. As John McNaughton wrestled with these conundrums in February 1964, his borrowings from Schelling are clear enough. I start with a report of a working group he chaired at that time. It contained three core propositions. First, a belief that striking directly at political decision-making could compensate for weakness on the ground. The focus had to be the North rather than the South, where progress would certainly be important, but also unlikely despite our best ideas and efforts. Second, that it would be possible to influence Hanoi's decisions by action designed to hurt, but not to destroy. This is pure Schelling. Third, and again following Schelling, a belief that a decision to use force if necessary, backed by resolute and extensive deployment and conveyed by every possible means to our adversaries, gives the best present chance of avoiding the actual use of such force. So the initial American force deployments, in line with this precept, would be on a very large scale. And here we have a recognition of the dangers of incrementalism that was later forgotten. The need from the start was to maximize the deterrent impact and menace of these forces. The gradualism would lie not in the size of the force, but in its use. For here McNaughton was concerned with what still had to be deterred rather than what just needed to be punished. Any use would therefore be carefully designed to have more deterrent than destructive impact, as far as possible. The basic principle was, a pound of threat is worth an ounce of action, as long as we are not bluffing. On the 4th of May, McNaughton, as head of one of the four working groups set up to develop options for the president, was tasked to develop this theory further. And by the 23rd of May, this group had come up with a scenario for strikes on North Vietnam. This assumed that little could be done within South Vietnam, an assumption that thereafter remains a constant in McNaughton's memos. He is now starting to develop ideas involving an elaborate combination of threats against the North, combined with reassurances that the United States was not seeking to overthrow the government in Hanoi. The issue of legitimation then forced itself onto the agenda as a result of the Tonkin Gulf episode of August 1964, when air raids against torpedo boat bases and supporting facilities in the North were justified as reprisals for alleged attacks, at least one of which probably didn't take place, by North Vietnamese patrol boats against the American destroyer USS Maddox in the Tonkin Gulf. These established both the precedent and the congressional support for later raids. This established the reprisal mode of communication with North Vietnam. As stressed by Dean Rusk, its advantage was that it kept responsibility for escalation on the other side. And the fact that it seemed to work so well in this case increased the confidence of American policymakers and helped establish in their minds airstrikes as a form of communication in their dealings with the North. In Schelling's books, Arms and Influence, again, of course, without the benefit of later historiography, Schelling found the Tonkin Gulf reprisals articulate and appropriate. He approved of the fact that the strike was directed against facilities connected with the original act committed against the United States. If the strikes had continued day after day against a variety of targets, he argued, the operation would have lost neatness. Quote, the sensation of justice would have been diluted, and the incident would have been less well defined, and it would have been harder to tell what was reprisal for the destroyer attack and what was opportunistic military action. But here Schelling had got to the nub of the problem in the conceptual framework with which policymakers were operating and which the Tonkin Gulf reinforced. He saw a reprisal as a reciprocal action, some punishment for a break in the rules, geared to an isolated breach of conduct, whereas opportunistic military action would reflect the underlying dispute and represent an attempt to change the rules. The temptation, as he recognized, would be to use a reprisal as a step towards this effort of changing the rules. And he saw possible virtue in this. The object can be a display of determination and impetuosity, not just to dissuade repetition, but to communicate a much broader threat. One can even hope for an excuse to conduct the reprisal as a means of communicating a more persuasive threat. And this aspiration can be seen in the memo McNaughton wrote after Tonkin, his plan of action for South Vietnam of September 64. Here, heavily influenced by this experience, he listed a series of possible actions, either covertly American or overtly South Vietnamese, which might lead to North Vietnamese retaliation. The underlying concept was, quote, by doing legitimate things to provoke a North Vietnamese response and to be in a good position to seize on that response or upon an unprovoked North Vietnamese action to commence a crescendo of South Vietnamese American military actions against the North. In addressing the problem of legitimation, the memo recognized three audiences. The North had to see that initiatives were being taken, the South that the administration was behaving energetically, and the public that it was behaving with good purpose and restraint. The question was whether all three audiences could be satisfied at the same time by the same set of measures. McNaughton's approach evolved into one of the three main options identified for President Johnson by late November 1964. Option A was to continue with present policies, which McNaughton assumed, though this was not stated explicitly, would logically lead to eventual withdrawal. Option B, which reflected the preferences of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, would involve a systematic program of military pressures against the North, at some point meshing in with negotiation, but generally carrying on until objectives were achieved. This McNaughton called the full fast squeeze. As with other civilian policymakers, McNaughton doubted that strategic bombing of the North could achieve much of direct military value, such as stopping the movement of men and supplies from North Vietnam to the South. So any air campaign had to have a political purpose. McNaughton therefore inevitably preferred option C. This was, I think, described as an archetype of the Goldilocks memo, where you start with something that's too small, then you have something that's too big, and the option C is just right. This is progressive squeeze and talk. This would orchestrate diplomatic communications with additional graduated military moves against infiltration targets. Withdrawal was not precluded by option C, but by trying and failing, somehow McNaughton believed that it would still leave behind a better odour than option A. It would demonstrate that the United States was a good doctor, willing to keep promises, be tough, take risks, get bloodied, and hurt the enemy badly. The strategic problem, therefore, had become one of trying to give the impression of commitment without being truly resolute, of following one course while not closing off others. Here we can sense the legacy of Cuba in the belief that a graduated response would allow the United States to keep control of the situation, whatever happened. With McGeorge Bundy, McNaughton described how, quotes, the military scenario should give the impression of a steady, deliberate approach and to give the United States the option at any time, subject to enemy reaction, to proceed or not, to escalate or not, and to quicken the pace or not. In late 1964, according to Halberstam, McNaughton asked his assistant, Daniel Ellsberg, later to achieve notoriety as the leaker of the Pentagon Papers, to find ways of rationalizing a potential American withdrawal from Vietnam if everything was lost. At the time, the question of preserving the reputation of the United States now seemed uppermost in his mind. At the start of 1965, he was advocating slugging away so that if we leave, be sure it is a departure of the kind that would put everyone on our side, wondering how we stuck it and took it for so long. As he pondered the next step, he is reported to have consulted Schelling over lunch about exactly how the North could be coerced in these unpromising circumstances. According to one account, the two men wrestled unsatisfactorily with the question of what could the United States ask the North to stop doing that they would obey, that we would soon know they obeyed, and that they could not simply resume doing after the bombing had ceased. Writing after the campaign had started, Schelling expressed himself very unsure about the coercive aspects of the bombing of North Vietnam. While he acknowledged the bombing as part of a class of actions which he himself had helped identify, this was quite a different situation in the character of the enemy, including its lack of a capacity to inflict direct hurt on the United States, the position of the ground on the ground in Vietnam, and the consequent importance of the adversary's military assets as much as his vulnerable population as a target for American coercion. He noted the criticism of the diplomacy accompanying the bombing and hoped that there had been private communications to Hanoi of a less ambiguous nature. He clearly did not wish the Vietnam build-up to be accepted as a clear application of his theory. There was not, and indeed there could not have been, a suitable theoretical framework at that time for South Vietnam, for scant consideration had given up to that point in theories of strategic coercion to the problem of shoring up a rotten regime against a resolute opponent. It was not just that the South Vietnamese government did not deserve extra military support, they could not cope with it. The previous September, the principals had agreed that the South was too weak to cope with the consequences of a more sustained air campaign against the North. As the president had observed himself, the reason for waiting then must be simply that with a weak and wobbly situation, it would be unwise to attack until we can stabilize our base. The first priority would be to strengthen the fabric of the government of South Vietnam. Typically, this was almost immediately followed by another attempted coup in Saigon. 3 months later, the president's view had not changed. This had put the onus on those anxious to avoid withdrawal that they should find something new to make up for those things we cannot control. The situation in Saigon, in fact, had got worse. Just as President Johnson had used the Tonkin Gulf incident to strengthen his political hand in the United States, Premier Khan had used it to declare a state of emergency and to give himself absolute power. This produced a crisis with Buddhist elements, in particular opposing Khan. For the following few months, political turmoil continued unabated. At this point, some began to see that South Vietnam might be beyond reprieve. Attempts to get Saigon to understand the imperatives of reform proved to be unavailing, and as the Americans pressed harder, relations with the South Vietnamese came close to breaking. Indeed, there was talk of asking Ambassador Taylor to leave by the South Vietnamese government. At the same time, the news from the battlefield was grim as the Viet Cong extended its influence throughout the country. And this was the context for McNaughton's preparatory work on rationalizing an American withdrawal. By late January 1965, Khan was maneuvering to retrieve his position and undermine civilian rule, despite his promises to the Americans to support a Prime Minister, Tran Van Hoang. He helped stir up Buddhist and anti-American agitation, which led on 27th of January to Hoang being overthrown and a new figurehead premier being appointed. That day, McNaughton's initial response was that this was reason in itself to dump South Vietnam, though that was not a course he was advocating. But he met that morning with Robert McNamara and observed that Khan was incapable of delivering the political stability required. Yet McNamara, influenced by the fear of falling dominoes, suspected that leaving South Vietnam would just mean that the location for the confrontation with China would shift. McNamara didn't see much point either in slugging away, for that was tantamount to drift. He wanted a definite policy, which either meant withdrawal or escalation. As he was disinclined to the former, he was left with the latter, which meant airstrikes against the North. In a draft memo prepared for the meeting, McNaughton argued that while striking the North might improve the situation, it probably won't. McNamara disagreed, though he recognized a political risk if there were no quick results. McNaughton's approach was then cautious, asking for no more than tit-for-tat reprisals, which his boss thought was too narrow. McNamara then went off for a fateful meeting with McGeorge Bundy to see the president. These two officials had established their position before the immediate crisis. In a joint memo of the 17th of January, they had already rejected the view that the United States should cut its losses and abandon Saigon to its fate. They feared that the president's response to the crisis was too tentative. He was averse to taking decisive action in Vietnam, Yet delaying a decision was in effect a decision to lose Vietnam. They had asked to see Johnson already on the 27th of January to express their concern that the policy that they were currently implementing was not working. They returned to the core catch-22. The policy had been to wait for a stable government before decisive action was taken against the North, but this stability had not arrived. Part of the reason for this, Bundy and McNamara argued, might be American inactivity. Quotes, "The Vietnamese know just as well as we do that the Viet Cong are gaining in the countryside. Meanwhile, they see the enormous power of the United States withheld, and they get little sense of firm and active US policy. There was no middle course left," they argued, while noting that Secretary of State Dean Rusk disagreed and wanted to persevere with the existing policy. McNamara and Bundy believed that it was time for harder choices. The government of South Vietnam might deserve little support, but as the objective was to make a stand against communist expansion, then it was necessary to make do with whatever anti-communist forces were available. At this meeting, the message appears to have got through. Bundy's notes quote the president, "Stable government or no stable government, we'll do what we ought to do. I'm prepared to do that. We'll move strongly. Can is our boy." Another covert patrol along the coast of North Vietnam was authorized to provoke Hanoi and provide a pretext for reprisal attacks. Meanwhile, the president dispatched Bundy to Vietnam to make his own assessment of the situation so that he could report back before the final decision was made. While there, he recognized that making do with Khan was less easy than supposed. A government with greater authority was needed. Nonetheless, he remained convinced that the ability of the United States to influence events in the South depended upon it being seen to act with far greater force. Thus, an air campaign against the North would not be designed with Hanoi so much as Saigon in mind. His report, drafted with McNaughton's help, noted that action against the North is usually waged as a means of affecting the will of Hanoi to direct and support the Viet Cong. We consider this an important but longer-range purpose. The immediate and critical targets are in the South, in the minds of the South Vietnamese, and in the minds of the Vietnamese cadres. This did depend on influencing the course of the struggle in the South. Somehow, a relationship between the bombing and the Viet Cong campaign would have to be developed, so that each could escalate or de-escalate with the other. But that supposed a substantial, punitive, coercive act to bring home to the North the hurt that would result from continuing to support the insurgency in the South. If this failed, or even worse, if it led to an intensification of the insurgency, then it was hard to see how the net result could be a boost to the South's morale. Moreover, it was difficult to see upon what basis a truly ferocious campaign might be launched. The civilians were still petrified that if the military were given their head, they would touch on one of the red flash points which would result in war with China. And still sensitive to the need, reinforced by Johnson's own desire to protect his ambitious Great Society program of domestic reform to legitimize each move. Thus, the Bundy report remained caught up in the tortured circumlocutions necessitated by justifying an act of escalation as an act of reprisal and a search for outrages in the South as a pretext for bombing the North. To this end, the murder of a provincial chief might do, but not a Hamlet official. A grenade in a Saigon cafe, but not a shot into a small countryside shop. Out of this came the policy of sustained reprisals, with the same refrain that at very least that this might enable the Americans eventually to leave with their heads still held high. Thus, a failed policy would still be worth it. At a minimum, it would damp down the charge that we did not do all that we could have done, and this charge will be important in many countries, including our own. The critical shift in the whole chain of reasoning which had hitherto shaped Vietnam policy had now been accomplished. A short-term policy of reprisals in terms of a visible demonstration of US commitment which would help local morale had become detached from a longer-term policy which, it was still admitted, must require a government which in one way or another be able to maintain its political authority against all challenges over a longer time than the governments of the last year and a half. The need for a respectable government in Saigon had all but been displaced by the need to be seen to be actively preventing the loss of the South. While Bundy was still in Vietnam, there was an attack on the American base at Plai Koo, killing 8 Americans and wounding 60 more. This provided more than enough outrage, according to the developing strategy. There was an immediate coordinated airstrike against 4 army bases in southern North Vietnam. The issue now was how far to take the action. When the president met with the Security Council on 8th of February, he acknowledged the basic shift in rationale. There is a bad governmental situation in Saigon, but it is our hope that current American action may pull together the various forces in Saigon and must thus make possible the establishment of a stable government. The communist reprisal raid to the American reprisal raid came on the 10th of February, when another American base at Quy Nhon was attacked. Following military advice, McNamara recommended an immediate retaliating airstrike to the National Security Council. It was agreed and implemented on 11th of February. At the same time, at McNamara's instigation, the Joint Chiefs of Staff forwarded an 8-week airstrike plan, confined to 4 targets a week within southern North Vietnam. The chiefs did not think that this would by itself have much effect, but it might, so long as it was seen clearly as the first stage of a process that could lead progressively to more serious punishment. Doubts as to the immediate value of the exercise were reinforced by a special intelligence estimate, which warned that the result might at worst encourage intensified attacks and at best lead to a tactical reduction of communist activity to gain a respite. Nonetheless, the plan was accepted and was to be implemented in conjunction with a reinvigorated pacification effort in the South and an expressed willingness to engage in talks to bring aggression to an end. Thus, policy on Vietnam, adopted on February the 18th, 30 years ago, next Saturday, called for a joint program with the government of Vietnam of continuing air and naval action against North Vietnam wherever and whenever necessary. Such actions to be against selected military targets and to be limited and fitting and adequate as response to continuing aggression in South Vietnam directed in Hanoi. As Gibbon notes, it's extremely difficult to assess what Rolling Thunder was designed to achieve because there was very little discussion of objectives at the meetings which discussed the decision to begin bombing. And in the middle of all of this, there was yet more political unrest in Vietnam, delaying the starts of airstrikes and eventually leading to the removal of Khan from office. This political confusion was once again seen to divert attention from the war effort, undermine morale in the United States and the South, and encourage Hanoi to believe that it was on the verge of victory. But once the transfer of power in Saigon was complete, with now Dr. Phuen Huy Quat in charge, the strikes were authorized on February 26, although the first raids did not begin until the 2nd of March. Rolling Thunder is naturally evaluated in terms of the competing objectives of coercing Hanoi to limit its support for the communists in the South, or stemming the flow of supplies reaching the Viet Cong, or supporting a move towards negotiations. The fact that these objectives were all unclear reflects the fact, somewhat played down in academic assessments of the campaign, that the immediate target for Rolling Thunder was morale in the South rather than the policy of the North. And at most in academic writings, morale has been acknowledged, as it was by some insiders at the time, as a potential spin-off of stronger action against the North, but not as a serious objective in itself. Undoubtedly, the fact that the effect on the South did turn out to be at best marginal and certainly transitory, so that immediate thought had to be getting in ground troops in a combat role, indicates just how futile a stratagem this was. As many had feared, the air campaign had the effect of increasing the North's efforts to achieve a quick victory, or at least to improve their position in an eventual negotiation. The official and actual American interest in a negotiated outcome was hopelessly compromised by the weakness of the South's position. This, of course, was precisely why in the past the strengthening of the South had been a precondition for action against the North. The administration had failed to achieve this through forcing Diem out, and then through hectoring his successors to reform their political practice, improve their military effort, and make pacification work. They did not want to insert large number of ground troops in a combat role, so they had seized on the only available action that could introduce something new into the situation, airstrikes. There was no reason to suppose that there would be any tangible improvement of the fundamentals in the South as a result of this action, and so it proved. Any benefit was soon overtaken by a surge of communist activity, which led inexorably to American involvement in a land war. This wholly contradicted the illusion of control which American policymakers were trying so desperately to preserve. They felt unable to walk away and acknowledge defeat, and yet somehow they believed that defeat might be more palatable if they were seen to have tried harder. Looking back in 1981, Schelling admitted that once in Vietnam, the problem was that nobody could think of a graceful way of getting out. The reason for being there, and it appealed to me, was, I wish now with hindsight that we hadn't done it. But now that we're here, among all the options, cutting and going just doesn't look good. Recall that even David Halberstam, writing in 1964, observed that the United States would dishonor ourselves and our allies by pulling out. Here was the basic tension that McNaughton simply could not resolve. Consider his most notorious memo, written in March 1965, just after the start of the bombing campaign, and just after he had visited Vietnam and come back with a gloomy assessment of anti-communist forces reduced in military terms to a series of enclaves. He then described American war aims as 70% to avoid a humiliating US defeat to our reputation as a guarantor, 20% to keep South Vietnam and the adjacent territory from Chinese hands, 10% to permit the people of South Vietnam to enjoy a better, freer way of life. In addition, he hoped that the United States could emerge from the crisis without an acceptable taint from methods. He emphasized the United States was no longer acting in Vietnam to help a friend. But the logic of this was for the United States to take over South Vietnam and accept it as a battleground on which to fight communism. But it was not enough to be ready to suffer for commitments. By the time this memo got to McNamara on the 24th of March, he had added a query as to whether South Vietnam could be bottomed out, either without extreme measures against the North and or without deployment of large numbers of American and other combat troops. And the answer is perhaps, but probably no. So at each stage, he accepted the logic, as he'd once feared he might, that the next step had to be taken, not because it would do much good, but because otherwise the United States would be humiliated. By the end of 1965, McNaughton was shifting his public as much as his private ground. The bombing campaign had proved a frustrating experience, and he had attracted the ire of the military by his attempts to micromanage target selection. He was now interested in physical barriers on the ground rather than contests of will. He recognized that bombing was unlikely to help so long as the North believed it would win in the South. He was a leading advocate of the bombing pause, which was announced on the 27th of December, 1965. And though this turned out to have been of no value, he continued to advocate further pauses. By January 1966, he had at last come to grasp the relative stakes involved. In Vietnam, he wrote, the communists probably think their vital interests are involved, and it takes some sophistication to see how the area automatically involves ours. It is not clear that we dominate the area militarily at the subnuclear levels. An honest opinion is split as to who is right in the controversy. We therefore have in Vietnam the ingredients of an enormous miscalculation. A year later, just before he died, McNaughton's office had become one of the most eloquent groups in the government arguing for extrication. The war, McNaughton is said to have observed, is shit. I've concentrated on McNaughton's role in the decisions of February 1965, not because his views were unique. His prescriptions in the end had to be derivative of his boss, Robert McNamara, while his ideas about graduated pressure could be found in any number of contemporary contributions to the debate within the United States government. Reading his memoranda 30 years on, one is struck by the dispassionate rationalism and the traces of strategic theory. In particular, he appears to have struggled more than most with the question of objectives and the relationship between the specific requirement of saving South Vietnam from communism and the wider need to look after the reputation of the United States. For this reason, he was profoundly troubled by the evidence that the policies he had rationalized on the basis that they would show the United States to be a good doctor turned out to have had a calamitous effect on the domestic equilibrium of his own country and its reputation abroad. He had never explained how the actions he proposed would actually enhance the reputation of the United States if it was still in the end going to abandon a major commitment. A good doctor about to lose a patient might want to show that every effort had been made to save the life, but the fact that the United States was not prepared to do everything possible to save this patient, and what it was prepared to do often seemed unrelated to the patient's health, undermined this image. The lesson of Vietnam is not that honor, face, or reputation are foolish as motives. Strategic theory does need to recognize that policymakers do care that their reputations for restraint, good sense, resolution, competence, commitment, clear vision, or whatever qualities they wish to claim for themselves are at stake in a crisis. However, such considerations cannot be detached from the immediate problem at hand or considered separately from performance. The attempt to preserve the honor of the United States as an international actor, as a great power and security guarantor, in the end floundered on the inability of the United States to justify to itself and to its friends the measures necessary to sustain its original commitment to South Vietnam. I mentioned earlier how sensitivities to problems of legitimacy became more pronounced in the strategic thinking of the early 1960s. It was evident in Vietnam in the attempt to use the safely reactive notion of reprisal to underpin a strategic initiative. But the administration did not believe its own public rationales, saw little merit in the government of South Vietnam, and understood that it was the victim of its own failings as much as communist subversion. Graduated response could not have succeeded in the circumstances of early 1965. Fail because it was not implemented with sufficient vigor, but because it began from an insecure foundation in the South, which could be weakened as progressively as the squeeze on the North could be tightened. What had been a prior condition, a modicum of stability in the South, was allowed to become an objective in itself. The self-confidence generated by Cuba led to an overestimation of the potential for power, and an exaggerated belief in the capacity to manipulate military force to send complex political messages, a concern for the sort of honor that might have followed a well-designed and well-executed policy was used to justify a confused and ruinous policy. The inevitable result was dishonor. Thank you.
Thank Professor Friedman for this eloquent exploration of the ingredients of an enormous miscalculation. I like that quotation. He's consented to answer, I think, one or two questions. I think we have a little more time, if anyone would like to ask a question. But if not, there is a reception where he will also be happy to talk.
You concentrated on McNaughton and obviously the line of policy development in Washington. Can you say to what extent that was influenced from Vietnam itself, General Westmoreland at the beginning and General Taylor? To what extent was there for a feedback, as it were, of operational influence into the policy making process in Washington?
From Taylor, an enormous influence. Westmoreland, coming to back up Taylor, what's interesting, of course, especially in view of Westmoreland's later role, is both of these were very much against, and Taylor right through with the introduction of American combat forces into Vietnam. And the fact that Taylor, who'd been chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was now the ambassador in Saigon, and he was recommending consistently against the introduction of ground troops, pushed the Americans back on to the onto the airstrike option. when you, the few times you see American policymakers discussing the large-scale introduction of ground troops, their tendency is, well, we better talk to Taylor about this. And he always said no. And Taylor expressed himself astonished. I can't remember the exact quote, but essentially having crossed the Rubicon with airstrikes, without even thinking, the administration moved into ground troops, which he believed correctly was a far more serious step. So I think his influence in removing one option was particularly important. He was a great exponent of airstrikes. He thought they would do good. I try to indicate that the people such as David Halberstam and others felt that the United States did have a commitment to South Vietnam, that there were high strategic stakes being played for there. And just walking away from Vietnam would have been difficult. But those of us who can remember the television pictures of the time of Buddhists burning themselves and the utter chaos in Saigon at the time, it would not have been hard to say there's not much more we can do for this government. And the option that McNaughton and others were looking at was just not announcing a sudden withdrawal, but just gradually edging away from the policy. The fear of someone like Lyndon Johnson was that he remembered what the right had done with the loss of China in 1949. It was not so much an international problem that worried him. It was what the right wing might do with the loss of Vietnam and how they would use it against his Great Society programs. And that also led to another problem of American policy, which was that Johnson never actually announced it. He didn't want to draw attention, even in February, March 1965, to what he was doing. They had enormous difficulty getting him to make a speech on the subject. He wanted to keep it a low-profile extension of current policy. So either way, that's, I think, what would have happened. It just one led to escalation, the other possibly would have led to withdrawal. But the final death knell of the regime in 1964 or 1965 might have been as humiliating as the one in 1974, which was bad enough.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Friedman, for a very intriguing and, I think, eloquent lecture.